Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Tony Wasilowski, a senior correspondent here at RFERL. Tony, thanks very much for joining me by phone today.
Nice to be with you again, Steve.
All right. Good to have you. Now, there's a lot going on in and around Russia, as usual, but I'd like to focus today on Belarus and, again, the Russian role there, or the Kremlin's role. This Wednesday will mark exactly 4 months since the August 9th presidential election, in which the Belarusian state claimed that incumbent Alexander Lukashenko won a sixth term with about 80% of the vote. Our opponents, and in fact millions of Belarusians, don't believe that for several reasons, including the fact that no election in Belarus since the one that made Lukashenko president in 1994 has been deemed free and fair and democratic by international observers. Another cause for doubt among many Belarusians is the fact that large, unprecedented rallies were held in the weeks before the election, many of them in support of Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, who became essentially the unified opposition candidate after several others seeking to challenge Lukashenko were barred from the ballot, and in some cases were jailed or forced into exile, which is what happened to Tsikhanouskaya after the vote. Tony, you wrote about these rallies and other developments in the run-up to the election. Now, 4 months later, major protests by Belarusians who say that Lukashenko stole the election and must step down have continued despite a severe crackdown by the authorities, with law enforcement agents in some cases accused of torture, rape, and other crimes against detainees. I believe 300 or more than 300 people were detained yesterday in Belarus, according to Vyesna, the human rights group. Tony, now before the election, you predicted a confrontation with Lukashenko, essentially determined to stay in power, and protesters unwilling to accept non-credible official election results. Did you think the standoff would last this long?
No, I didn't. And the reason for that is just that we've never seen anything like this in the post-Soviet history of Belarus. The only thing that comes somewhat close to this was the reaction after the December 2010 election, where there were protests immediately after the Sunday vote, and they were immediately repressed with hundreds detained, opposition candidates arrested and jailed, and that became known as Bloody Sunday. And then looking further through the record, in 2017, in February, there were big protests in Minsk against what was called a parasite tax to make people who didn't work over 183 days to pay the equivalent of some $200 because they weren't gainfully employed. And looking at a report from the time, there was a crowd of, say, 2,000 people in Minsk, which Reuters described as one of the biggest protests in years in Belarus. So this gives you a kind of a sense what we saw as far as protests went in Belarus, and that mainly was due to the fact that Lukashenko's crackdown repression instilled great fear in Belarusians. They knew if they went into the streets to protest, they would pay a severe price. And we're seeing that today again, as with the numbers you point out. Every weekend, there are protests, hundreds arrested, beaten, tortured, reports of torture, that are hundreds that are very credible. So that it's still going on at this point, I'm surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was there, and I think it was embarrassing to say, I think it was 2006 after another disputed election. And there was, an opposition tent camp in one of the squares, the main squares. It was protests for quite a few days. And then the tent camp was swept away by the authorities. I mean, but these were protests that were, they were sizable, but they were not comparable to what we saw, both ahead of and now after the August election. So, yeah, it seems, and again, the numbers continue to be, I guess you would say, surprising, given the crackdown. So it's quite a tense and protracted standoff. Let's turn to the Russian role. Some developments lately, not much in terms of straightforward statements or actual actions, for that matter, as far as we know, but certainly some signaling from Moscow in recent days and weeks. Late last month, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met with Lukashenko in Minsk and told him essentially not to forget what he had agreed with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Sochi in September. And now in televised remarks last week, Putin said that he hopes that, quote, the Belarusian people will build a domestic political dialogue with all political forces, unquote, and resolve the situation without external pressure. Now, part of that, I think, was an effort to suggest, you know, as Lukashenko and Russia have done, that the West is interfering. But leaving aside the question of Russian interference with all these comments and meetings, he does seem to be calling on both Lukashenko and his opponents to enter talks, enter some kind of a dialogue. Tony, what do you think is going on here? Do you see any kind of goal or motive behind Putin's remarks and the other developments?
Sure. I definitely think the Kremlin is confidently aware that they hold most of the cards vis-a-vis the fate of Mr. Lukashenko. You know, analysts like Kamil Kvasinski, he's a senior fellow at the Warsaw-based OSW Center for Eastern Studies, recently wrote that basically Lukashenko has deprived us of any room for maneuver on the international arena, principally cooperation with the West, mm-hmm. with this crackdown. So he has, in the past, he would pivot towards the West when he felt, you know, pressure from Russia. That option's no longer there. He's being blacklisted by the EU. His government's facing sanctions. So he's cut off any kind of dialogue there. And Russia is aware of that. But on the other hand, they understand that with his growing problems with legitimacy amongst the populace in Belarus, that the Kremlin doesn't want to be associated with him for more than is possible. So I think they want to orchestrate, or they want to have some type of change within Belarus. Again, experts are saying that they want to see, you know, some type of constitutional reforms carry out, so that if he does remain in power, his power is greatly weakened, and that makes Belarus more susceptible to Russian pressure. It seems like the cause for the union state have kind of been Russia isn't pushing that right now because they understand that they hold a lot of levers over him right now.
Right, so it wouldn't be a very good idea, I guess, to sort of push for the idea of integration at this point in the eyes of Belarusians.
For example, the Russians also, with this, you know, there was this $1.5 billion loan that the Russians extended to Belarus in September.
Right.
Of that money, about $500 million has been dispersed, and most of that money went to pay off Belarus's debt to Gazprom. So the Russians, while on the one hand have extended him, you know, assistance, they're being very kind of frugal or doing it in a very calculated manner. And you know, and I think Lukashenko understands he doesn't maybe have the firm Kremlin support that he might like. But he's stated recently that, you know, he would see himself leaving once constitutional reforms are enacted. But when that would happen, if that would happen, is unclear. And opposition thinks it's just another time stalling tactic of his.
Right. I mean, that was a very interesting comment by Lukashenko, which came, I guess, a day after Lavrov had said, you know, don't forget these Sochi agreements. So, but again, as you say, you know, there's certainly no timeline. Things are pretty murky in terms of the possible constitutional change. Another thing, you know, talking about signals from Putin, Lavrov, there's also been what may be signals from, you know, in the Russian state media and non-state media, like the RIA, which is RIA Novosti, one of the state news agencies, had a very straightforward report the other day. Basically saying Canada says Lukashenko has lost legitimacy. And, you know, on one hand, it's a straightforward report. It seemed accurate. On the other hand, you know, is this a way of and a similar thing was, I think, said in one of the main Russian papers that's not a state owned paper. But, you know, the question is, are these kind of signals also to Lukashenko that, look, you know, as you said, Tony, it's kind of you don't have many options here. And we're your kind of lifeline. So, you know, get with the program.
Yeah, definitely. And there's another piece, the other side. I think you're referring to Moskovsky Komsomolets saying, you know, stating that, quote unquote, is a hard fact that Lukashenko's lost his legitimacy in the eyes of the Belarusian people. And, you know, casting this as a foreign inspired movement that this would somehow push Belarusian into NATO's hands as a result, so that the Russians have to, the Kremlin has to, you know, tread warily about how much support it wants to continue to extend to a leader who is more and more despised by his people.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
so I think there's definitely an awareness there, and you see that from the Belarusians have said. Those taking part in these protests have said over and over that this wasn't aimed against Russia. This is a purely domestic affair. But then others questioning why does Putin continue to support Lukashenko as this crackdown continues and gets bloodier? So
right, it does put, I think, you know, just despite all the power that leverage that the Kremlin has, you know, it is in a somewhat difficult position for that reason. All right, we're running out of time. We're going to have to wrap it up for today. Tony, thanks very much for joining me.
It was nice to be with you.
All right, thanks. Okay, I'll be back next Monday with another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. Meanwhile, please keep an eye out on Friday for my Week in Russia newsletter. Thanks for listening.